I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 203 of Caro Pop. If you'd like to support us, please go to caropop.com. Our guest this week has written and performed music that has a special place in my heart, Luis Perez of Los Lobos. If you've been paying attention, you know that Los Lobos is one of my favorite bands, and Kiko from 1992 is a Desert Island disc, even as I love their other albums too. A Kiko song, Saint Behind the Glass, has special meaning to Perez, who takes a rare lead vocal on it. Who has written many of the band's songs with guitarist-singer David Hidalgo, was inspired by an actual saint statue from his family's home. Now that statue is in Chicago as part of an interactive display for an exhibit, American Prophets, Writers, Religion, and Culture, opening November 21st at the American Writers Museum. Perez is coming in for it before Los Lobos plays two shows at Evanston's intimate club, Space, on November 24th and 25th. Perez tells the stories behind the saint, the statue, and the song, as well as how the band's landmark album, Kiko, came together, and how they all felt when they first listened to the playback. But before we get there, he opens up about a recent health issue and how he's bouncing back to join his longtime bandmates on the road again. He refers to those bandmates as his brothers, and it's no wonder. Perez, the original drummer, and Hidalgo started writing songs together in high school in East Los Angeles. Singer-songwriter-guitarist Cesar Rosas and bassist Conrad Lozano joined the new band's lineup in 1973 and never left. The relative new guy, saxophonist-keyboardist Steve Berlin, joined in 1982. In his Caro Pop episodes, Berlin talked about leaving the Blasters for Los Lobos and asking the latter band when all the shouting would start. Perez explains why it never did. Perez also digs into his songwriting dynamic with Hidalgo and the element that comes first with most of his songs. He explores the impact of Los Lobos' 1987 smash cover of Ritchie Valens' La Bamba. He discusses his and Hidalgo's trippy side project with Mitchell Froom and Chad Blake, the Latin Playboys, and how it fit in with Los Lobos. He says whether, 10 years after their last album of original material, Los Lobos is preparing new music. He addresses how he and other artists can meet the moment amid the national government's current toxicity toward immigrants. Offers inspiring words for anyone involved in the act of creation. He's as candid and open-hearted as you might expect from his music, and I love talking with him. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Luis Perez.
Someday that wall will crumble, tumble and fall. The sun will shine, bring peace to us all. Say yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm glad I look good to anybody. I had a heart attack 4 months ago, four and a half months ago.
No. Wow. Yeah. So are you okay? Are you,
I'm okay. I'm okay now. After 4 months of rehab and having to go back in and do another procedure and all that, you know, stuff like that. Yeah. It was a rough 4 months, but I'm back. I got cleared and off I go.
You're playing at two shows at Space, which is actually walking distance from me, which will be fantastic to see you there. Are those your first shows? Is this the first time you've been out since this happened?
I've got two of them under my belt now. Yeah, and they're one-off shows. That worked out fine because, you know, I had to kind of just dip my toe in the water a little bit. And you really know what it is, and you'll know that I'm not discreet about anything. I had a lot of anxiety about like getting on a plane again and doing it because I was on the road when it happened. I mean, it's not very original, but
no. Well, but you know, were you between concerts? Were you in a hotel room? Like, what happened?
Well, I'm telling you, it sounds kind of corny. It sounds like a bad B movie. I was on stage playing the encore, and in my case, I was playing La Bamba.
Oh wow!
And I walk off stage and I tell my road manager, "Hey, I've got a chest pains," and he says, "Oh, okay." I said, "Give me a call when you get back to the hotel," because he's got to finish up and stuff, you know. So I went to the hotel and just kind of walked around the room for about 20 minutes, and he calls, "Hey, what's going on?" I says, "Well, I had chest pains I made it real clear. It was past tense. I had chest pains. Now I feel it's gone away. And he said, "Well, we're going to the hospital." I already called up, and there's a hospital about 8 minutes from here. We were in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, in the Berkshire Mountains,
Oh, wow.
and went to this little tiny hospital with 25 beds, and it was. And they checked me out, and they said, "Okay, well, you got a slightly elevated heart enzyme, which usually signals something is going on or happened." And they said it's right around 30, so it's very low, but it could just be some leakage, and it'll reabsorb itself overnight. So we'll check you through the night. In the morning, the doctor woke me up. She said, "Your blood enzyme went from 30 to 440." And within 20 minutes, I was in a medevac van on the way to Springfield, Massachusetts, to the level one
Oh,
hospital there.
wow. So you had like more of an episode in the hospital and they had to transfer you.
Oh, they couldn't handle anything. That really, I mean, just a little tiny hospital. They were really great. They're really cool. And then I went to the big boys over in Springfield.
Wow. I've been in Great Barrington. Were you actually the theater in Great Barrington right
You know
there?
which one. Then
I
you know
do.
which
Yeah,
one.
there's just the one.
Yeah, just that one. It's a great little theater. I mean, I love those converted movie houses. They're nice and warm sounding, and been around for a while. They're all broken in already, kind of like an acoustic guitar you've had for like 25 years.
Yeah, I do too. It's but anyway, I just want to finish up with so you went to Springfield. Were you in the hospital for a long time there or?
I was there for 6 days because it's a level one hospital for cardiac events. And I got there on Friday at evening, and then Saturday morning, it's just impossible to get a procedure done, because they were going to put in a stent. So they put me on a list for Monday. Then Monday came, and then I got bumped, because that. Their perception was, I was kind of okay. I'm stable. They got me hooked up to, I forget what, heparin, which is a blood thinner. And they brought it. They were taking care of people that were coming in that were waiting all weekend with with more serious cardiac problems. So I waited. Then finally, they got me in on Tuesday. They released me. I spent the night in Boston, and then the following morning, my wife flew out, and then we flew home. And a road manager is, knighthood, sainthood, whatever you call it, because
Well, good that he took you
he stayed
seriously.
with us. He stayed
Yeah.
with us.
Oh, nice.
He got my wife out there, and he didn't leave when everybody else, he sent everybody else home because they had about 2 gigs to do after this happened. And then he stayed with us another couple of days, and then he flew back with us to make sure that we were all right.
So
So
the band had two.
he's going to get more than a Christmas card.
Oh, yeah. So the band had two more gigs on the tour after this happened.
So he had to walk in to the dressing room and tell the guys they had a heart attack. So I wish that was, I could have been the fly on the wall for that one.
When
These are my brothers.
absolutely. Well, I was wondering if they could sort of, were they able to come visit you in the hospital or did they have to like go to these other cities?
Gigs, man. I'm telling you can't slide an index card in the schedule. It's tight.
No, it is. Yeah. Because I was thinking otherwise, getting serenaded by your brothers would be pretty nice at least. But,
I got phone calls. Then that was good. Yeah, I went home, and I didn't see him for 4.5 months. So I saw them for the first time in Minneapolis when we did a fundraiser. It's a good plan. Like I said, the one-offs are good. Just getting myself kind of reacquainted this, which is like, that they say it's like riding a bike. We get back to something that's routine like that.
had
To
you
me, I
had
like
heart
to see.
issues before, or was this, like a shock to the
No,
system?
okay. I've been vegan for over 30 years, which is before it was even cool, right? I was a vegan. I've been clean and sober for 35 years. I quit smoking over 20 years. And I don't carry any excess weight. I'm in excellent health, and My dad died at 46 of a heart attack. And I, you always hear about hereditary stuff.
Sure.
I never gave it a little, much thought, and I didn't realize how profound it is and how important the hereditary thing is. They had me. I was filling out forms like all day, like crazy. Every time I get a form about hereditary, it was like your father's side, your mother's side. Do you have an uncle? Do you have a cousin? Do you have a friend that knew somebody with it, with the heart conditions or in their families? And I didn't realize it was so strong. It is incredibly strong. And I tell everybody that what they need to do is take a simple test, which is a calcium scan test, which is kind of like a CT scan kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it gives you a calcium score to let you know how much buildup there is in your arteries. And everybody's got it. It just depends on how much you got in there. They can determine right there on the spot whether you qualify for a stent procedure or you need to do something about cholesterol and, like a diet change, exercise. But I'll tell you, if you do have enough that qualifies you for a stent, you get to do it then. Don't wait till after you have a heart attack.
Yeah, sure. Did you
Yeah.
get any sort of instructions on things you need to change now?
There isn't much for me to
I
change.
mean, it sounds like you have a pretty healthy lifestyle already.
Yeah. My doctor, I was in the paramedic van, and my doctor called because I sent him a text, and he called me and said, "Hey, what's going on?" Because I gave him the numbers, and he was like, the heart enzyme numbers. Okay, I got those numbers from you, but there must be a decimal point in there that's missing. No, there's no decimal points. That's the actual number. He says, "Well," and he said, "Lou, you had a heart attack." And I go, "Yeah, I'm kind of figuring that's what happened." And I said, "But how does this happen? How do you know?" He's known me for 20 years. He knows everything about me, and he knows what I do, everything. And he says there's three things. Your age. Hey, I've never been 72 before, and he says your family history, and your lifestyle. So you can't do anything about your family history, can't do anything about your age. So only thing you have control of is your lifestyle, which for me is playing rock and roll. And there's no rock and roll for seniors, as you know. You do it just as hard as you do as the kids do, and nothing's going to make Poughkeepsie any closer to Manhattan. It's always going to take that long to get there.
Right.
So
Was
whether
it
it be
scary for you to get back on stage for the first time after this?
Yeah, there was a lot of anxieties. There was like a not quite a laundry list, but there were things like getting to the airport, just leading up to getting on the airplane, and I don't want to say power through it because I don't really like that term. I just put one foot in front of the other and check boxes. Okay, on the plane. Okay, we've taken off. Okay, we're landing. Okay, put all that stuff behind me. Once I got it all behind me, I was okay.
When you got to La Bamba in the set, did you have a moment?
I left.
So you just stepped off the stage at that
No,
point?
no, no. I wouldn't play it. No, I walked off stage. No, I'm kidding you.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Well,
which is
I
always
wouldn't blame you,
awkward.
but
No, it's not
you,
that
and you
bad.
didn't you guys didn't say, we're not doing La Bamba tonight. Come on, you guys, you've heard it before.
No. You always you play your hit. Yeah, I mean, I've heard from everybody from John Lee Hooker to everybody's always said you got to play your hit. You got to play your hit.
Right.
Yeah.
But you got through the song and you didn't, you weren't like, you're just like, all right, I'll just play it. It's just another song in the set. Doesn't matter what happened last time.
Yeah, I just played the song. I could embellish it. Writer's embellishment. I could say, that I looked around at the rest of the guys, make sure they were okay for the American Prophets show.
Your piece is based on Saint Behind the Glass, which is a fantastic
That's right.
song that I've listened to like 1,000 times because
Well,
Kiko is one
thank
of
you.
my Desert Island Discs.
Yeah, the table that's between my library, the table in between the bookshelves, is empty because that's where he lived. He originally lived on the dresser top at my mom's house in our bedroom, because we all slept in the same room, which is a tiny little house when I was growing up. And that's where it lived, up on the dresser top altar, like most Mexican American homes, Mexican homes period, have dresser top altars. And the centerpiece of usually those altars is a saint that the family has a special devotion to. In my case, it was Santo Niño de Atocha, and was in this. I don't know if you've seen pictures of it yet. It's in a wooden box with a glass door and all and windows behind it, and he just sits in there. So it lived, like I said, it was a place here in my home. And when my mom died, I took him home, and he's been with me ever since.
And
He's
that's
probably
what's
a
going to be
hundred
on
years old.
display at the
That's
American
what, yeah.
Prophets.
Yeah, and which is a cool story too. So Carrie calls me up and says, and explained this whole thing that was happening. And so I said, "Wow, what an incredible exhibition!" He goes, "Would you think about letting us borrow the Santo Niño?" And I said, "Because you knew all about it, already. I think we've been friends for a while. I did a book reading there when my book came out of, geez, 5 years ago." And he said, would you loan it to us for this exhibition?" And I went like, "Oh boy, okay." And then I said, if all the necessary logistics are taken care of, I would, but I got to talk to my wife." So I talked to my wife, and she said like, "Oh God, really? I don't know about that." She took a little while, and then she finally said, "Well, it's a pilgrimage saint, so yeah, why not? You should go to Chicago." So we took measurements, and he had a pelican case built for it with a die cut for the to drop him into. And he flew to LA. He rented a car, came to the house. We fit him into the case, threw the latches on it, put it in the back of his car, and he drove to Chicago.
Really?
Yeah, he wanted to be sure. He said, "I can get an airplane seat for him, but I feel more comfortable just hand carrying it the whole way." And I said, "Like, okay." And I said, "I wish there were like cameras set up on the for the whole trip, But he took pictures. But it's kind of a cool thing when you just think about it that he made that trip, after being part of my family for. When I was a kid, that thing must have been at least 50 years old. So he's got to be over 100 years old. So it's quite it's exciting.
Well, and so you're going to get here to Chicago, where I am, and you're going to see this saint that's been in your home and in your life for so long in this
Oh, yeah.
totally different context, and other people will be able to share that experience with you. It's going to be
Yeah.
interesting.
I'm really excited about that. I mean, he inspired me to write that song because it's about my, growing up in that little house on Hamel Street in East Los Angeles. So I think it's great that he's gonna like, we're gonna bring the story to a lot of people, and hopefully it'll inspire them.
When you wrote that song, it's on the song, it's on the album Kiko. Were you sitting sort of writing songs for that album, and you thought, oh, you know what? I'm just gonna, like, how did the inspiration come to you to do that as a song?
Yeah, absolutely. We're doing a Kiko, which was a really unusual record for us, and still is. It's known for its eclecticism and its sort of magical realist imagery that I'm just kind of repeating what other people wrote, because when you're making art, you don't think about that. So, and it just came to the to this. I was reading a lot of haiku, renga, and tanka back then, and Japanese poetry, and I thought of wanting to do something like that, do like the haiku or the renga kind of thing where it just goes around and around, and then it just hit me. Yeah, why don't I just write a song about my growing up in this house, but Sort of through the eyes of this saint that's sitting up on the dresser top altar, you know, watching everything go by.
Right. Yeah, it's the saint's point of view, which is part of what's interesting and cool about the song.
And it does do this repeat thing. It goes round and round and round.
Yeah, no,
But
and it,
then it ends with the line that the saint behind the glass tells mother not to cry, because in doing that, I also remembered when my father had died, and the mourning period for my mom after that. So I just figured that this saint behind the glass, there's something near the Atocha, gave her a comfort. I'm sure you did.
in a dream.
So you and David Hidalgo had been writing songs together since you were in high school?
High school, yeah. We're just out of high school.
So,
about 55 years, maybe.
And that's like in the early 70s. Kiko is 92?
92, that's good. You're good.
Yeah, and...
We'll get a lotto ticket.
There you go. Well, I'll tell you, I mean, just to back up, and then I'm going to ask my question. As someone who, discovered you with How Will the Wolf Survive... It was one of those exciting things when you're a music fan where you hear a band have this progression from that to By the Light of the Moon to Neighborhood. You had La Pistola, you had La Bamba over here too. But in terms of you guys making your own music, Neighborhood to Kiko, those four albums aside from the EPs, it was just this amazing progression of stuff. And Kiko, I mean, I love the Neighborhood too. But Kiko just blew my mind because it just was musically such a fusion with a small F. There were just so many influences and things happening, and it's eclectic, but it's just more like the stuff that I love about rock and roll in a way that I've never heard it before. And what my actual question was, aside from just saying how much I love that record and just the progression of what was happening with Los Lobos, was being curious about how you and David wrote together, and whether you would sort of write something like the lyrics of Saint Behind the Glass and hand it to him to write the music or finish the music, or are you sort of coming up with some music for it? Like, what was the how'd it work?
Well, first of all, I'm a songwriter. David's a songwriter. Ideally, we'd sit down with pencil and a pad of paper and a couple of guitars. But as things kind of progressed and time becomes a luxury, we weren't writing together anymore. So I lean more toward the lyrical part, and his first ideas are the musical thing. But ultimately, we both get together to work out the final details
Right.
of the song. And up to the minute when where he's singing it or whatever, I'm in the control room or whatever, however it works. So I just have to say that it would be discounting him to say he was a musical component. It would be discounting me to say I was only the lyricist. We are songwriters.
Yeah, I think that there's a sort of a shorthand when you read stuff about you guys where it's like that you're known as the lyricist, but you're writing music too. You're obviously playing music. So for that song in particular, was that one where you came up with the music and the lyrics and then refined it with
That
David?
is a really good one. I think what happened was that I wrote the lyrics, and again, because I was following a not a beat by beat sort of thing, but I mean, I used a template of Japanese poetry,
Right.
haiku, renga, and tanka, those three forms, and so I wrote it as that, and then I showed it to David, and then we got this idea of doing a kind of a folkloric thing, using folkloric instruments, because there's the Veracruz harps on it, and then there's a jarana. And so we came up with the music that will serve the lyric.
Right. It has this kind of cyclical feel to the music and the
That's
strumming
right.
and all of that as well.
That's right. Exactly right.
When you wrote the lyrics to it, you didn't have the music in your mind at that point.
No, I had it. I read it. Wrote it as a poem.
Interesting. And is that how you do a lot of your stuff, or do you come up with some stuff with a guitar in hand and.
Yeah, it goes back and forth. Like I'm saying, like it. I'll. David will have an idea, and he'll play it for me, And there's a dynamic that I can't really explain, because sometimes just listening to the music kind of inspires something. Like Good Morning Aslan, that song, I remember that we went back into the studio because Dave had this idea and these chords. And so we called Pete Thomas back in. That's he's the drummer for Elvis Costello's Attractions. He's been on a bunch of records. And we called everybody back in for this one last song. And David went in there and he was running it down, just doing like the basic track or just the idea. And then I don't know, I just heard it in my head. I heard Good Morning Aslan. And then I said, oh, okay, this could be the day in the life of any Mexican family in East Los Angeles. And it starts with the morning, and they're getting the kids to school, and the mom's doing the dishes, and the dishes are piling to the ceiling. It's kind of sort of this almost comical sort of way the day starts. And it was like almost like a creation myth, but it was a day in the sun coming up in East Los Angeles. So that's how that came together. And all inspired by just something I heard. And then again, it happened with a song called Gates of Gold. I heard Dave noodling with the idea, and it just kind of came to me. I don't know what happens.
So
I guess
sometimes the
that's what
music, sometimes the music is sort of the seed, and sometimes the lyric idea is the seed. It just, there's no formula to it.
That's right. For Latin Playboys, Dave created all these. I don't like to use experimental, but the only thing that kind of gets across to anybody, I mean, they can understand, trying some unusual things. And then I was writing a bunch of stuff. So like the lyrics were written separate from the music, and we just kind of fit them together. So there's different ways of everything. The one thing that I do know is that whatever I write, I have to believe that it can come out of Dave's mouth. Because that part I have to believe. I can't
Right.
write anything that I can't imagine wouldn't fit him. It actually coming out of his mouth, like I said.
So is there stuff that you don't write or put forward because you think, oh, this is good, but it's just not, doesn't sound like David?
No, because I start with the idea that this is, after so many years, I think it's just intuitive. I know what's going to fit and what's not, and where I can push it a little bit and where I can't.
And you probably hear his voice while you're writing anyway, because
Yeah,
he's
I
been
think
with it for
so. I think
55
that's
years
it.
or whatever.
I think that's right.
And like the town and the city, that whole album has sort of this reflective, like memories of you growing up feel to it. Was that something where you actually went into that project thinking, I'm going to write this sort of song cycle about this, as opposed to just kind of coming up with songs and going, oh, that's how these fit together?
That's exactly right. I wrote it as with a story arc. It starts with the valley, and then there's again sort of like a creation thing, like people coming, discovering a new land, and that in my head was Mexican people coming to America. And this was like prior to anybody, before the Southwest was ever populated by anybody else except Mexican people. And that's the arrival. And then I believe it follows with the Road to Gila Bend, which is a story of an immigrant coming across the border late at night. And then it goes into another song called The City. And the whole arc kind of takes you all the way to the last song. It's called The Town, which it talks about just growing up in East LA and growing up in those neighborhoods. It could mean anybody that at one time was displaced for whatever reason, and then you're going back home. So
Right.
that's what it was. But it was written that way. As a matter of fact, when Steve Berlin, who's real good at sequencing, our records, he got a hold of this, and he was looking for the sonic peaks and valleys, And he sent me the first idea of how the songs would be sequenced on the record. And I said, wait, hold up. There's a definite beginning, a middle, and an end to this. And then I explained it to him. He said, oh, okay, yeah, I get it. And that's why Town of the City is really a mark of there's a literary connection to it, you know, the way a story is told.
Sure, yeah, that's how it feels. It has that feel to it. And when you're sort of coming up with a concept for something like that, or sort of any of your albums, there are the songs that you and David do, and then there are the songs that Cesar Rosas does. Do you kind of just coordinate with him, like, hey, you know, we think this album's going to be about this, so keep that in mind when you're writing your songs, or?
He just writes, and you know, I think a lot of it is that we've been together for so long. I mean, we're a band for 10 years before anything ever happened, before you're across the LA River into these clubs, and finally got to like discover. It took like you know, being that we're now at this point we're 53 years old. A lot of this stuff, I don't know. It just it it it. You can you call it intuition? Can you call it just? It just all everything kind of fits together. Caesar's songs strike an incredible balance between what Dave and I write and what he writes. It just makes perfect sense. Perfect sense
It's what
that.
Los Lobos Records are
Yeah, that's what
and
it
have
is.
been for a long time. It was funny, Steve Berlin, I talked to him a while ago, and he was talking about how he was playing with the Blasters and then playing with you guys. And at some point, I think he was on the bus with you, and he was like, when does the shouting start? Because he's like, the
That's
Blasters are always
exactly
yelling at
right.
each other, and you guys just seem to get along.
Oh, I remember you're absolutely that's great because we were touring for the first time. We were in a van, you know. We got some of the money from Slash Records to buy this old van, and we toured across America for the first time. And he was waiting for like the fights to break out, and like he would say, I don't want to go to McDonald's, ready to like fight. And we said, okay, Steve, where would you like to go? We've been a band for 10 years. We had already got all the fist fights out of the way by then.
Were there ever, you know, major conflicts within the band, or just conflicts within the band over like direction, you know, what's going to happen on the next album, the sound, any of that sort of thing?
Not really. No. It's stuff that just can come up between like brothers, you know, but as far as we just trust each other. Yeah. You know, there's a if I could digress a little bit, you know, there's a Mexican work ethic that people have don't really pay attention to much or talk about, is that if it's important enough for you to ask a question or make a request, then it should be important enough for us to execute it, to do it. If somebody asks a Mexicano to get, can you move this pile of rocks and put it over here? That's what goes through their head. It's important for enough for me to For you to ask that, it's important for me to do that for you. And there's no committees. There's no you they don't they have to like all get together and talk about it and vote on it or anything. It's just that's what you need to do. It's an interesting thing. And I think for us as a band, we've always been very democratic, and we've always feel that you know this. Okay, if this is what you need and what you want, then it's our job to do that for you. And it's an incredibly democratic system we have.
It was interesting when you guys did the Latin Playboys, and it seemed like there was some sort of overlap there, because I remember getting the CD compilation of Just Another Band from East LA, and it had this new song, a couple new songs on, and one of them was New Xanadu, which then showed up on the Latin Playboys
Right.
record. And I was just kind of wondering, like, what the transition was from that, going from Los Lobos to Latin Playboys, that was like, you know what, this
No,
is an offshoot.
actually went the other way around. That's why, because it was written out of the songs that we had collected for the first Latin Playboys record, and then we pulled it out and put it on the Lobos record. And I remember Mitchell Froom saying, "You know what? I want the News and Do back." Because we had Chad Blake, myself, Mitchell, and David, did this project, and we actually called. I came in, and he said, "He said, well, you know how we're going to approach this? We're going to be a band." And he says, "What do you mean?" Because we're a band. You and Chad are members of this band, and we're going to call it Latin Playboys. And he said, "I haven't been in a band for 30 years, and it's going to be called Latin Playboys." Okay, thank you. And so that's how that happened. And then he says, "You know, I want it back. Let's put it on Latin
That's our
Playboys."
song.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, and it was no problem. That, again, there's no committees, no voting. It's important for you.
There's no tension over you guys forming a side project.
No, people were scratching their heads a little bit. I remember there was a LA Times article that talked about that. Like, what's everybody doing here? Caesar's doing this over here, and it's Steve, this what's going on here? Yeah, I will explain. We go on a retreat. We go on an adventure. We always go back to the mothership. That's Los Lobos, and that's always been the case.
Right. Yeah, I saw you guys at Park West, actually. You did a Latin Playboy show. It was very cool. I love that record. It was again, it
I
was
like
like
it a
it was
lot too.
exciting for me, to just see this progression of you guys just kept pushing, in different directions.
It, you know, it got to a point where I didn't feel I wanted to for the band to take responsibility for my experiments. And again, there's that word experiments again, and I don't care for it. But we just that's the way we did. We kept everything separate.
But I felt like Latin Playboy's record did influence Colossal Head. Like, I felt like Colossal Head, I mean, obviously it's still a Los Lobos record, but and maybe you would have gone in these directions anyway, but there were kind of these groove-based songs,
Oh yeah.
and it just had a different feel from what anything you'd done at that point too.
The Colossal Head was a total riff record. It was all there. All those songs are based on a riff, and so that's what just came out of David. He just he had become good friends with Billy Gibbons, and he was like way into ZZ Top and a lot of like that sort of thing. And so, a result of that was that we wrote a bunch of songs that were based on a guitar riff. They're fun songs.
Right.
Wasn't Mossy Moss on that one too?
No, it just
Yeah, that's on. Jeez,
explodes.
that's yeah. I really love that record.
When you
I
start off with that
never
amazing
stopped for.
bass groove of Revolution, too, I mean, the bass line on that is
Oh
something.
yeah, this is a good. This is a. It's always been a good band, from the very beginning. Yeah, it's all blurry, of course, and then of course everything is blurry when you hit 70. That's a weird number. And now it seems things start to fall off the rails a little bit. So I, at now at this point, all of my recollections are like this hopefully incredible simulation of fact.
Well, how much does memory play into your songwriting in the first place? It seems like it's a pretty strong element.
It is. It is. I can't write about it anything else except my experience. So, that's what I always draw from that pool of experience of growing up in East Los Angeles. And the only thing I made an effort to do in telling those stories was to not be like on the nose about it, like this way that people can interpret it into their own lives, because. Everybody feels the same, and things actually, got a little more specific with songs that are directly talking about the immigrant experience that is. But aren't we all, who came from somewhere else? So that's what was the only thing that I did. I've always tried to make the songs universal.
Right. Well, and unfortunately, the immigrant experience has become this kind of toxic topic under the current administration. What is your reaction like as an artist or otherwise to what's going on?
To lend ourselves to wherever the needs are. I mean, we've always been connected to things that affect basic things, like food. Like we've been involved with food banks and supporting and things, and we always have some local charity present at our like a table or something at our shows. So that's always been part of what we do. So I would say to make ourselves available, we always kind of ramp things up when it's around election time, and without we've never like hit anybody over the head with a picket sign. We always felt that our music and our presence is enough, but I think it takes a little more than that now.
Yeah.
We try to get engaged. Sometimes I feel like I kind of regret that we haven't been more engaged. I think the fact remains, and this absolutely, whoever's listened to this, not a cop out, okay? But there was 6 weeks in the summer of 1987 when a 100-year traditional, 100-year-old traditional Mexican song played by four Mexican kids from East LA was the number one record in the country. And ended up being one of the biggest records in the world. And I think there's a lot of that's pretty loaded with I think it's a, that's what really shows a lot, just our presence. But I think there's more. There's more that we need to do. We're artists are in an interesting place because I've always been aware, and even more so now, is that whenever we go up on stage and perform, that we're building a community. When there's people packed into a theater or wherever it may be, and they might not be like-minded as far as the rest of whatever else they do, and for that 90 minutes or 2 hours, they're all. They may have never imagined speaking to each other outside of that room, and that's community.
Right.
And I think the fact that that a band who goes on stage to play music, the only requirement for each of those musicians is to listen. And I think that's a blueprint for a community.
Being in the room with everyone else, and it's something that we lost during the pandemic. And then when you come back to it again, you just are so grateful for it because sharing that love of the band, of those people on stage, and the music that you've created, and it bonds everyone together who's in there too.
That was a really interesting time. I really didn't know what was going to happen. I couldn't imagine everybody wanting to go back into those rooms, and I was completely wrong. As soon as the things opened up, they packed all the
We
place.
missed it. Well, there was a while where it was like the rooms were kind of less full than usual. Everyone's wearing their masks and everything, but no, we missed it. And you guys stay out on the road. Are you writing and are you guys recording? Like, what's the status of all that?
We write on demand. I mean, whenever we get a project, that's when we start writing. I'd like to say we're writing all the time, but that's not the case. Touring is time consuming and grueling, and we just about don't even say goodbye when we get to we land back home at the airport. We say, "See you later." And then that's it. We're working on a couple things in the studio that have to do with a documentary film that's being made on us.
So that's Native Sons that originally was announced as coming out this year. It seems like it's not coming out this year.
No, it's not coming out this year. It's just it's like everything, anything else. It just takes a long time to put together, and right now nobody's spending any money on anything, so it's really difficult. And it's still there's I believe there's still a kind of a learning curve how things are get produced with the advent of streaming and Netflix and all these other platforms. It's affecting everything.
Sure.
And then the economy now is just, nobody's turning loose any kind of money to support anything. So it's taken a while. But
I mean,
it's looking good. It's looking good.
your last album of original material, because you had Native Sons, which was mostly covers in
Yeah.
2021, and then you had Gates of Gold in 2015, so that's
That was
10
the
years
last
ago.
one.
I mean, do
How
you
many
have
years ago was that now?
10, 2015?
10 years old?
Yeah.
Yikes.
I mean,
Yeah, I
do
guess,
you have like a bunch of songs that you've written and you and David have written and César's written since then that would be ready to go for an album or?
No, again, I think Caesar has a studio in his house, and he spends a lot of time doing that. David's got a bunch of grandkids, and family life because of the juggling you do between being gone and being at home requires a lot of attention. So, again, I preface by saying that I wish we were writing all the time, but that's not the case. We
And you're
can't write
someone who
all.
writes with like a project in mind, as opposed to just being like, oh, I just went through this experience. I need to pull out my guitar and process it musically or something.
I guess we're kind of like the roofers that roofs leak, the roofs leak, and the plumber whose toilet's backed up. It's just we don't want to think about it like when we get home because we work so much. But now that we're slowing down a little bit, not on the road as much, not going up for long stretches of time anymore. Last thing we did was just shoot trucks about 3 years ago. I think it was right after the pandemic or right before. I don't know what it was. But we're out for the good part of 3 months, and we're not going to ever do that again. We're not even going to do 3 weeks. So we're trying to slow down a little bit, and I think it's freeing up a little bit of time. I mean, I've always kept notes all the time, so I'm always listening. I usually pick up things out of conversations like we're having right now. There's been songs that I collect titles. I get a whole bunch of titles. Usually for me, a song starts with the title, with some kind of phrase.
Interesting.
Tin Can Trust. Wow, that sounds kind of cool. And then you just kind of build from there.
That's really interesting. Yeah, because everything sort of has a because sometimes it's just a phrase that sticks in your mind and then it just suggests a whole
Yeah.
world. So.
I was talking to a friend in Kalamazoo, Michigan. My friend Jay, he's a dentist. Orthodontist. I'm sorry, Jay, if you're listening to this. And we're just talking on the phone, and we're like talking about stuff. And then we were talking about about money or something like that. And I just said, I keep mine in a can underneath my bed. It's my tin can trust. And the words came out of my mouth, and I said, like, wait a second. And then it became the title track of a new record.
Right. So
So
you probably
you
have like
never
this
know where it's
backlog
coming.
of great phrases like that that are like waiting for songs to be written
Yeah,
around
and
them.
I go to that list. Made to Break Your Heart from Gates of Gold was there's a couple on that list that I used. I go back to that, I'm always adding to the list all the time.
Nice. Well, I'm grateful that you're going to be in Chicago for all this different stuff because you have
Yeah.
this exhibition, and then you have a couple shows at Space, which will be a fantastic place to see you. So,
Yeah, and it's going to be an incredible exhibition. I mean, the whole theme, American prophets of, writers and spirituality. It's a really interesting topic. I mean, and the way that things are set up, the same behind the glass is right next to Flannery O'Connor's rosary. So I'm in good company, you
Oh,
know.
that's fantastic.
Yeah, it's gonna be great. It's such a really great idea. I know it's gonna be well attended, and yeah, I can't wait. I'm gonna make a road trip, special trip to go out for that.
And it put this great song in my head for like the last couple of days, ever since I read about it. So when you wrote that song, did you think, oh, this is like one of my like major songs? Like this is going to be one that sort of holds on in a way that, is above some others, at least.
Yeah, well, it certainly was a song that was very personal, one of the most personal songs I've ever written. So that I felt that it's become a really popular song that people love, and I didn't expect that. I don't think about, like, wow, this is the magnum opus of everything I've ever written. Kiko, I think as a whole, I think is something like that, which I was not aware of at the time. It's a record that kind of made itself. That's why I named it rather than calling it something. That's why it's called Kiko, because it's kind of like a living thing. It's like a person. And I remember listening to the first listening thing, where we saw listened to the whole thing as a whole, and I don't even think we talked after that. It just like it was overwhelming even for us that something like that it could happen. Which is another thing about this exhibit, you know. I think the act of creation is kind of like an act of faith. You got to trust. If you sit down in front of a canvas, if you're a painter, or you sit down in front of your word processor or whatever, or a pad of paper as a writer, or a musician, you could just have to have faith that it's going to happen. It might not happen today. It might be a little frustrating. It could happen tomorrow. It could happen, you know, Thursday. But you have faith that it's going to happen. That's why you always show up. That's important. Why, you know, we have to show up.
Well, as a writer who always is trying to juggle a lot of stuff and has a lot of friends in the same boat, that's really great, inspiring advice there. So I appreciate it.
Yeah, great. Well, thanks for visiting. Thanks for taking the time.
Oh, thank you, and I really appreciate it. Your music has meant a lot to me over many, many years. This was a real treat for me. So thank you so much. I really
It's
appreciate
been
it.
great. It's really great knowing you, and I hope this, like Humphrey Bogart said, is the beginning of
Beautiful
your friendship.
relationship. And
Yeah.
I hope that your little health thing is this little blip that you look back on many years
Yes.
later and say, well, that was like a scare,
The
but.
docs say I'm all rebuilt, and I've added miles through the odometer, and that's good to know.
That's all for episode 203 of Caropop. Thanks so much to Louis Perez for opening up about his creative life and work and health and offering so much inspiration and great music. His Saint Behind the Glass display can be enjoyed at the American Prophets exhibit opening November 21st at the American Writers Museum in downtown Chicago. And if you're in the Chicago area a few days later, catch Los Lobos playing at the Evanston Club Space on November 24th and 25th. These are rare opportunities to see this great band in such an intimate setting. The band also has a series of December dates in California. Go to loslobos.org/tour for more information. And if you're not that up on Los Lobos' catalog, start with How Will the Wolf Survive and work your way forward for one of rock's more thrilling progressions. Caropop is produced by Chris Swake, who works behind a different kind of glass. Thanks to all who support Caropop. If you'd like to throw something into the Caropop kitty, we'd be much appreciative. And I'll give you a shout out on the next episode. You can give $24 or whatever you'd like at caropop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Carroll. Please follow Caropop on the so-called socials at CarolPopcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Carroll at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe here and on YouTube, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Caropop conversation. Thanks.